In cybersecurity, speed isn't just an advantage, it's survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system against hackers. SOC Radar continuously monitors the external threat landscape, so cyber threats hit your radar before they hit your business. But it doesn't stop there. SOC Radar empowers your company with proactive exposure management, actionable insights that help you stay ahead of cybercriminals and minimize business impact. And with SOC Radar's holistic exposure management, you get complete visibility, attack surface monitoring, dark web monitoring, threat intelligence, and brand protection are all unified in one powerful platform. SOC Radar isn't just another tool. It's your frontline defense in a world where threats never sleep. Get started with SOC Radar today. Right now, you can get a free dark web scan by going to socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, it's John and Steve here, and today we're doing things a little bit differently and sharing a really fun episode of another podcast that we think you're going to enjoy. It's called Business History, and it's made by our friends over at Pushkin Industries. Steve, you listen to a lot of Pushkin podcasts. Tell us more about this, and what is Business History all about?
The reason I started listening to Pushkin podcasts is because it was founded by Malcolm Gladwell, an author I've literally been listening to for 20 plus years. And that led me to a whole bunch of other podcasts like Against the Rules with Michael Lewis, A Life in Lyrics with Paul McCartney. These are exciting podcasts. So when they reached out to us about business history, I got really, really excited because I knew that Pushkin made very quality podcasts. And with the former Planet Money hosts, Jacob Goldstein and Robert Smith, it was obvious that this was going to be a great show. Now, business history is all about telling the most exciting stories in the history of business. The great mavericks, the incredible innovations, the huge surprises. But the reason that we're sharing this podcast right now is that it actually is a movie story, because they are telling the story about how Thomas Edison claimed to invent the motion picture and then used that claim to dominate the early film industry before the turn of the century. But this isn't just a story about one of the greatest innovators in American history. This is a real crime murder mystery, because it is also the story of the real man who actually invented motion pictures. And that is Louis Le Prince, who got onto a train in 1890, ready to tell the world about his invention, and he was never seen again. Did Thomas Edison murder the real inventor of motion pictures in order to steal his patent and dominate the industry? The only way for you to find out is by listening right now to Business History with Jacob Goldstein and Robert Smith from our very good friends over at Pushkin Industries.
All right. Well, here's the murky story of who deserves the credit for making movie magic. We hope you enjoy it. And if you do, find more tales of founders' business success and spectacular failures on Business History, available now on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. Too quick?
No, that was perfect.
Pushkin.
Stop. You got it.
Robert Smith, we're starting this one with a little true crime.
Oh, I love it. Bring me back.
It's the fall of 1890, and there's a guy named Louis Le Prince. He's French, and he's about to show the world that he has invented the movies, moving pictures.
Love it.
He's spent about a decade at this point developing a camera / projector. Almost went broke a couple times, but finally now he has it. He has done it. He's built a camera. He has filmed the first movie ever made, and he's going to go to New York to show the world. He's going to have the premiere of all premieres.
The very first one, yes.
The premiere, number one. But first, he decides he's going to go visit his brother who lives in, as you say, Dijon.
This is the Frenchest story ever,
in France, yes. I think he does have a mustache also. From there, he's going to go Dijon, Paris, Paris, London, London, New York. Couldn't go direct at that time. And so he goes to visit his brother, spends a few days there. And then on September 16th, 1890, Louis Le Prince, the man who invented movies, gets on the train from Dijon to Paris. He is never seen again. He disappears. His wife at that time was living in New York, his wife Lizzie. And, you know, she's waiting for him to show up. But at that time, people are late. Things happen. But she starts to get nervous, and her nervousness turns into panic. She starts going down to the Battery, down to the southern tip of Manhattan every day to watch the ships come in and, you know, see if she can see him off the ship. Nothing. And so she's contacting her family back in England. She's contacting his brother in France. Nobody knows anything. He's gone. And then on May 28th, 1891, this is less than a year after he disappeared, Lizzie sees this headline on the front page of the New York Sun. Why don't you give it to us? Read it to us.
The Kinetograph. Edison's latest and most surprising device, pure motion, recorded and reproduced.
Lizzie reads this headline, and she thinks to herself, I mean, I know what happened. It's obvious what happened. Thomas Edison killed my husband and stole his idea.
J'accuse.
I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm Robert Smith, and this is Business History, a show about the history of business.
Well, smug. A little smug in the read today.
I'm proud of this show.
Okay.
This is our third and final episode about Thomas Edison. In the first episode, we talked about how Edison invented this whole new way of inventing things. Second episode, he brings electricity to the world, but also manages to screw it up a little and bet on the wrong horse. And today we talk about Edison's last big success, the movies, the motion pictures.
Kind of the key theme, the sort of big idea in the show today is simultaneous invention. You know, the sort of classic invention story, and this was like, say, true of Edison and the phonograph, is one guy or one team just coming up with this idea that nobody saw coming, making this huge breakthrough out on their own. But that's unusual, right? A lot of the time, maybe most of the time, big breakthroughs are not like that. There are all these different teams, and everybody knows that a breakthrough is coming, and everybody is racing, working on different techniques to get to the same place. And it's really interesting to look at the story and think, well, in that setting, who wins, who loses, and why? And in particular, in this case, it's the story of how Edison does not invent the movies, but still wins.
It's also about a murder.
There was a murder in the show today.
Allegedly.
I mean, the guy definitely died.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And he would have by now. But
oh,
yes.
Yes, they're all dead now. So let's pick up the Edison story. We're going to pick it up in 1887 when Edison has just turned 40. He's 40 years old. And he moves his lab from Menlo Park to West Orange.
The Wizard of West Orange. Actually, that sounds pretty good.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
But he's still the Wizard of Menlo Park. But now he has a much bigger and better lab. You know, you remember from the first episode,
he had everything in one place, in one room, essentially.
Yes. And so now he is an international celebrity with backing from the most powerful and rich financiers in the world. And this new lab reflects that. Actually, lab isn't even a big enough word. It's a compound, right? So he builds like a factory where they're making phonographs, you know, the record players and the records to go on them. And then the lab is this like super lab, multi-stories high. There's a machine shop. And then the sort of heart of it is the lab, right? And now Edison can buy everything. He buys every metal in existence, apparently. Of course, thousands of dollars of chemicals. And then I found this one list that I guess it's just like the plant and animal products they bought. And I love it. Read it for us.
I picture this wall and we're reading the things along the wall, right? Hog bristles, porcupine quills, tanned walrus hide.
I guess you don't want the raw walrus hide.
Yeah, exactly.
Smell,
it stinks, right?
Yeah.
Skins of every known animal.
Every known animal. It's like Noah's Ark.
A pound of peacock tails, a dozen bull's horns, just in case 11 is enough, a dozen walrus tusks, 25 pounds of marlin, the fish, marlin.
Is that for eating? Like, I wonder, 25 pounds of marlin, is that for snacking or for inventing?
That's the whole thing. In Edison's mind, you never knew that there was going to be some solution and some guy's going to say, Marlin? We got Marlin.
I mean, so there's a few ways of thinking about this, but like the simple one is He wants to be able to invent everything all the time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he's doing at this point. He's got hundreds of workers, and he's assigning all different people to all different projects all the time.
But still, at the age of 40, like, it's been a while since Edison has, like, had a big hit.
Kind of.
Yeah, right? I mean, he moved to Menlo Park in the late, 1870s?
Yeah.
And came out with the phonograph.
Right away, right? Like, right away.
Everyone's like, this is magic, right? Light bulb, everyone knows about this. Now, what?
He's working on lots of different things. He's spending money. He's trying to invent iron mining. That's actually what he's really into at this point. He's bought an iron mine, and he's built this ore milling plant, and he loves to go out there and get dirty. He's actually working on a little electric car, sort of a proto-electric car. And then the key moment, really, in the movie story happens in 1888, when he meets with this guy, Edward Muybridge, kind of this minor historical figure you might have heard of. Muybridge was a photographer who got famous. It was actually when he helped settle a bet for Leland Stanford, the guy who pounded the golden spike in the Transcontinental Railroad. There was this bet: do horses lift all 4 feet off the ground when they're running?
And they're running so fast, you can't tell.
You can't see it, right? And Stanford said yes. And so Muybridge had developed this technique where he could take rapid sequential photos of, like, animals in motion. So he actually goes to Stanford's horse farm in Palo Alto, will later be Stanford University, and takes these pictures of the horse running. And in fact, you can see they do lift up all 4 feet when they run. And so Muybridge gets famous for these kinds of photos. And he's talking to Edison about it. And, you know, if you think about, oh, rapid sequential photos of an animal in motion.
If you string them together fast enough,
yes,
it will be a movie.
Yes.
It seems obvious.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it was basically obvious at the time. People, in fact, had started to make flip books, which is, you know, this idea. There was this toy called a zoetrope.
Oh, yeah, I've seen these. Yeah, with the little slits in them, and you spin it, and you can only see one picture at a time. But it's like a guy doing cartwheels or, you know, someone running.
It's animation, right? Yeah. It's this simple little animation. And so this is all in the air. And after his meeting with Muybridge, Edison assigns one of his assistants, like, okay, this is another project for us among all the, you know, all the other things we're working on. He says, go figure out how to build a photographic system that can capture motion.
And at the time, this is Thomas Edison, the inventor, right? You have the idea, you delegate. You say you have a room full of all these animals, do what you have to do.
Yeah. And when Edison tells this guy to go off and work on it, he does not know that Louis LaPrince, the guy we talked about at the beginning of the story, is way ahead of him.
So let's talk about Louis LaPrince.
Louis LaPrince was born in 1841, a few years before Edison, a little older than Edison. And I should say, by the way, the details of his life come from this book called The Man Who Invented Motion Pictures by Paul Fisher. It's a good book. Paul Fisher was generous enough to talk to me, actually. So he was quite helpful in putting together this show. So Louis' father is a French army officer named Louis LaPrince. Louis has an older brother named Louis LaPrince.
It is a perfect name.
It's a very good
name.
Why come
up with another one?
Why reinvent the wheel? His mother is not named Louis. His mother's name is Elizabeth. And he grows up moving around France because his dad's in the army. And, you know, this time, the middle of the 18th century, is technologically incredible.
And we've talked about this, right? It feels like every day something new is coming.
And so Louis falls in love with both technology and art. And he decides to devote himself to sort of combining technology and art, right? So he apprentices with a painter, but he also studies optics and chemistry. And he winds up as a photographer, which is like the perfect Venn diagram overlap, right? Photography is just like a few decades old at this point. It is a new technology. And so he's working on photography. In France, he falls in love with this young British artist named Lizzie, follows her back to a town called Leeds, which I am informed is in the UK. They start an art school together. And LaPrince is really into these sort of creative applications of photography. He gets well known for combining photography with pottery. There is this moment in his life that comes in 1880, so years before Edison starts thinking about motion pictures. LaPrince is 39 years old. He's married. He has a couple kids. He's kind of restless.
Yeah, he's a 39-year-old man. He wants to, like, spend time in the garage tinkering with his tools and pottery.
Live the dream, right? So, yes. And, in fact, he does have a little workshop out behind the house, you know, a little photo studio. And one day he's out there working, and he has in his hand, like, a glass plate and a piece of paper that both have the same photograph on them, like a portrait, I think. And for a sec, he sort of drops them. They start to slip out of his hands, and he reaches down to grab them. And as they're, like, falling through the air, he sees this motion, and he thinks, ah.
You know, listen, I feel like when people tell these stories, what they're doing actually is trying to capture that feeling of an aha moment.
You're saying it has truthiness?
It has truthiness. Like, it felt to him that he had this insight. And indeed, he did have an insight. He's like, this is possible.
Yes. You're saying maybe it didn't happen. Louis LaPrince, from this point on, devotes his life to figuring out motion pictures. He calls this moment the spark. And, you know, he has this vision, and it seems kind of hokey in retrospect, but, like, admirable in its way, that moving pictures are going to, like, bring the world together. You know, people of different nations will see the way foreigners live, and it will make them understand their common humanity or whatever. And so he is, in fact, going to spend the rest of his life on this. And not long after this moment, he rents a bigger workshop. This one's in town. And he hires a machinist and a woodworker, and he hires his son, Adolphe, to come and work with him.
I know that we've spent two episodes talking about Thomas Edison, but I am kind of rooting for the artist at this point, right? I'm always rooting for the artist against the big industrial might at this point of Thomas Edison. But you have to think about, like, how hard this is going to be, right? Film moves at 24 frames per second. And if you have glass plates, that's what he's working on. He's thinking about glass plates.
Like, that's what they're using at the time.
I mean, 24 times a second, you're going to go tick, 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 tick. Like, it seems impossible.
Yeah, like, how are you going to even have that many glass plates? How are they going to not break, right? And yet, this is a moment when somehow the movies feel kind of imminent, right? Like, everybody is working on this problem.
And more than that, everybody's paying attention to everyone else. This is the most recent recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics, came up with this idea of these ages of innovation were really about communication.
Huh.
It was really about a time when everyone's sending letters to each other, you're reading about each other in the newspapers. Obviously, patents are coming through in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And so there are times when not only are people feeling the spirit of invention, but they're seeing exactly what other people are doing.
Joel Mokyr won that Nobel. Yeah. And you mentioned patents, which is really interesting, right? Because patents are in the U.S. Constitution, famously. The founders felt that strongly about them, in part because what a patent does is it makes you publish your idea, right? Patents are public, and that is the point. And, like, Edison is, like, reading every patent or having people who work for him read every patent that comes through. That is core, this idea of sharing knowledge.
And we see this with the invention of the internet. We see this with recently about AI. People are innovating, but they're innovating in public and announcing almost immediately, we've done this, we've managed to do this and figure this out. And it leads their competitors to say, like, well, if that's possible, maybe this other thing is possible.
Yeah, that is this big idea of simultaneous invention, right? And, like, the AI example is really interesting because, you know, the key breakthrough in AI in, like, the last decade was just a paper that Google researchers published, right? They figured out a better way to make AI work on basically on NVIDIA chips, on GPUs. And they could have kept that as a trade secret, right? Google could have just built its own AI model and people went, wow, why is that so good? But they did the opposite. They published it. And so that is what's happening with the movies in the 1880s, right? Everybody is working. They're kind of working in public. People are patenting things when they get patents. And so LaPrince, as you said, he has this problem with the glass plates, right? And so first, he builds this 16-lens camera that is, you can see pictures of it, that is amazing to behold. Because his idea is, like, what if you could just have one plate and have, like, 16 exposures?
Like the eye of a fly.
Like the eye of a fly. It's a fly camera. And then somehow you would, you know, play back each one. But, like, that doesn't work for an interesting reason, which is because the lenses are like next to each other, each one is from a slightly different point of view, right? And so it has to be the exact same shot for the illusion of motion to work.
Because it'll be jumpy. It'll make you sick. Yeah.
So the real breakthrough for Le Prince comes from somewhere else. Also classic innovation, kind of adjacency driving innovation. In this case, it's George Eastman of Eastman Kodak. Perhaps you've heard of Kodak.
I have.
Used to be a great company. George Eastman invents paper film. And, you know, George Eastman is not interested in the movies, right? He wants photography to be like a hobby for everybody instead of a thing you need professionals to do. And obviously, George Eastman is wildly successful. But Louis Le Prince sees this paper film and thinks, aha, I don't have to use glass plates. And in fact, paper film is not ideal for the movies. It's not translucent
yes.
entirely.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit translucent. Also, it tends to catch fire because you got to put a bright light behind it to project.
Yeah, move it quickly. Sure.
That's a
yeah.
problem. But it works. Le Prince is able to build a movie camera. And it's this beautiful mahogany box with like brass hinges. Like in Williamsburg, they would go crazy for this camera.
He was an artist at his heart.
And in October of 1888, Louis Le Prince makes the first movies ever made. It's in Leeds, where he's living. There's actually a few movies he seems to make on this one day. And one of the movies survives and is, in fact, on YouTube.
Oh.
So I put a link in the notes. So here. Let's watch the movie. Okay, you want to count us in?
Okay. So it's called Roundhay Garden Scene,
that's right.
1888, Le Prince.
That's it.
All right. Settle back. Get your big bag of popcorn. You know, relax. Really, you know, put yourself in the mood of watching a movie. Let's hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And it's over.
That's it.
That's it. It's 2 seconds long.
2 seconds long.
The very first movie.
Yeah.
It makes it super hard to like show this in a movie theater. Imagine the movie phone, you know, Roundhay Garden Scene shows at 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock in 10 seconds. 2 o'clock in 20 seconds.
But think of how many tickets you could sell.
Oh, right? My God. You could pack it.
So let's actually talk for a sec about what's going on in the movie.
Yeah.
How many people? It's 4 people on the screen.
They're awkwardly, I would say, standing there, except it's as if Louis Le Prince, who I assume is behind the camera, told them, I'm about to hit record. I don't know what he would have called it. I'm about to start the machine.
Yeah.
Move around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just start doing something. So there's a main guy who's sort of walking directly at the camera and then starts circling around.
That's Adolphe. That's Louis's son.
Okay. And there's in the back an old guy with a top hat who is dancing, I guess. He's doing a little jig.
Yeah. So that is Adolphe's grandfather, Louis Le Prince's father-in-law.
And then there's a couple other people who are just like, there's a woman and they're just sort of like
jiggling
friend, a bit.
A family friend and Louis's mother-in-law. But here is the thing. You're mocking it. We're watching the invention of movies.
And the first time, it's like that first phonograph record, that Mary Had a Little Lamb. The moment you see 2 seconds of this, and I assume it was longer.
Originally longer. This is like what lasted.
But even at 2 seconds, you can see exactly what it's going to be. You're like, oh, I can have a whole scene here and I can see people's faces and I can see movement and I can see cities I've never seen before. Like the dream that he had of bringing people together is obvious as we make fun of people from 150 years ago on YouTube.
Yeah. And, you know, this is just a guy in a little workshop in Leeds with a few people. Like, you know, you talked about rooting for the lone inventor. This is, at least at this moment, the victory of the lone inventor.
For a moment, savor it, because there is someone else who's going to come back into the story.
Thomas
Alva Edison. And we'll have his part of the story after the break.
So, Steve, it looks like we have a new sponsor on the Cinephiles, and I understand you've gotten some good use out of them.
Dude. Since we've been working with Secret Nature, my sleep's been better, my stress level is down, and I've been more productive.
Wow, that sounds like a major change knowing you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, between the podcast, being a dad, and I mean, the world, I wasn't exactly in top form. But when I tried the Secret Nature Daytime Gummy, I got like a clean, cool feeling. I mean, I could feel my shoulders literally dropping down a couple of inches, and I was able to stop focusing on a whole bunch of things I couldn't control and sit down to deal with some of the things I could.
That's fantastic. I know a lot of people would love to feel this way. And your sleep is better too?
Oh yeah. I used to wake up all the time and not be able to get back to sleep. But Secret Nature has a great nighttime gummy that not only helps me sleep through the night, but I am waking up refreshed and focused.
That's great, brother. I love that. And if you all want to try Secret Nature gummies, you can get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code CINEFILES. That's secretnature.com, code CINEFILES. Try them out today.
And we're back. We watched the round hay garden scene 400 more times.
Let's get back to Edison now.
Okay.
When we left Edison, it was early 1888, and he had just told one of his muckers, to go off and invent moving pictures. The guy he told to invent moving pictures was named William Kennedy Laurie Dixon.
Four names.
Four names, and he liked all four.
Yes.
He would sign things WKLD.
Yes.
So a little full of himself, but like also a hustler.
Yeah.
And an important player in the movie story, as we'll see. So WKLD grew up in England. And when he was like 18 or 19, he actually wrote to Edison to ask for a job, as I'm sure thousands of young hustlers did. Edison says no, but WKLD comes to the U.S. anyway and eventually does get a job working for Edison.
Shows moxie.
Yeah, he's got moxie. And he is an engineer, but he also is Edison's personal photographer.
Of course, Edison has a personal photographer, which, you know, at this point in Edison's life, like, he realizes that he is a brand.
Yeah.
And
maybe the most famous person in America. Like, it's we got to make it clear. Like, he's not just like nerds love him. Like, everybody knows who he is.
Yeah, but I say the word brand because he uses that to get what he wants, to make progress, to get money, to get investment, to get his inventions out there, and to win. Like, he knows that it's good for business that whenever something's invented in the middle of the night, he can step in at the last minute and have his personal photographer take a photo of him next to it.
Right. By William Kennedy Laurie Dixon. And, you know, this is part of the reason Edison assigns him moving pictures, right? The kid knows how to use a camera. So remember, this is 1888. By this point, Le Prince has been working for like 8 years on the camera. Just a few months after Edison assigns WKLD to work on moving pictures, Edison writes a letter to his patent lawyers.
I am contractually obligated to read everything that you tell me to read. So
please read it.
Okay. I am experimenting upon an instrument which does for the eye what the phonograph does for the ear, which is the recording and reproduction of things in motion, and in such form as to be both cheap, practical, and convenient. And there's like a little drawing of a machine in the letter.
Yes. Although that machine is not going to work at all. It's, in fact, when the movie camera is invented, it's not going to be that.
It was the poetry of this that was going to get Thomas Edison ahead. So he has not invented the movies, but he's written a thing that kind of sounds like maybe he did. And when he does, he can say, well, I wrote this beautiful paragraph, right?
Yes, yes. It is a legal gambit. And I just want to note, part of the reason I want to talk about this letter is it's October 8th. 1888. The day that Round Hay Garden scene, that first movie, was filmed is October 14th, 1888.
Ah.
Same week. So it's not legal precedence. Le Prince already has the patent. But just the vibe of simultaneity is what I want to capture here, right? Like, it is extraordinary how much everybody is working on this.
And Edison's first instinct is to get his lawyers to lock it down. Like, put it on paper. File it.
Yes. And what Edison is applying for isn't even a patent. It's this thing called a caveat that is just like, well, I'm not ready for a patent yet, but I got the idea. And so if anybody else tries to get in on it, you got to come check with me. And, you know, you were talking a minute ago about Edison being aware of his own brand and that serving him. And it certainly did for sales and for raising capital, but it also served him in intellectual property. Like, there's a pretty compelling argument that, like, in the same way that, you know, LeBron James can get away with committing fouls and not getting called the way ordinary players would because he's famous. And it's like, no, surely LeBron James wouldn't commit that foul. Like, Edison could do that with patents, right? If a bunch of people have competing claims, which is often the case because simultaneous invention, Edison will get the benefit of the doubt because he's Edison. He's the most famous inventor in the world. Of course, he must have really invented this thing.
Yeah, and LePrince, back in his backyard shed, has to know this, that he is not the most famous guy in this race. And so his motivation is, I need to make it work, and I need to show it to people that it actually works, not just written on a piece of paper like Thomas Edison did.
Yes, yes. Like, everything gets litigated, right? Everything is a race. And so the way you win is not just in court with patents. It's being first to market, being first to show the thing, being first to go in a room and say, hey, look, I built this movie camera. Here is a movie. No one has ever made a movie before. And so LePrince, yes, he has built his camera and made his movie and has his patents. Now he needs to show it to the world.
Okay, the battle is set. The lone inventor versus the most famous man in America. The little guy versus the industrial invention machine. Oh, this would make a great movie.
Yeah, yeah.
If they existed yet. Go on.
Louis's going to go to New York, right? He's going to have his premiere in Edison's backyard, basically. But first, as you may recall from the beginning of today's show, he's going to go visit his brother in Dijon in France. And it's not exactly clear why, you know, maybe he just wanted to see him, but it is the case that Louis had had some money problems. There was an inheritance, like a house, I think, that they'd inherited from their mother. And so maybe there's some money situation.
Classic, going to argue with the family.
Classic,
yeah.
Classic.
Yeah.
So he goes to see his brother in Dijon, gets on a train to Paris, disappears, is never seen again. And let's just do that New York Sun headline one more time.
You know I could do it forever. The kinetograph, Edison's latest and most surprising device, pure motion, recorded and reproduced.
And then Lizzie sees that headline and thinks, Thomas Edison stole my idea and killed my husband.
With 5 pounds of peacock feathers.
That's what the 25 pounds of Merlin was for.
Lizzie at the time, because this has taken over her husband's life and now he's missing and sees this, like, she has got to be so full of rage. They do have the film, though.
Yes, they have the film. They have the camera. It's there in Leeds. And he has a patent, right? So it seems like a robust legal case. It's obviously not going to bring her husband back, but at least, you know, you could, whatever, have his,
yeah,
make have his name, make yeah. your move. But there is this element of intellectual property law at the time that is devastating for Lizzie making this case. And that is this. If someone is missing, there is 8 years of waiting period before they can be declared dead. And while they're missing, their property, including their intellectual property, is in this kind of limbo, right? So Louis LePrince owns this intellectual property, and maybe he's still alive as far as the law is concerned. So in this key moment in the development of movies, Lizzie can't do anything. She can't bring a case because it's not her intellectual property to sue with.
Do we think at this point that Edison has seen the film? I mean, he has his fingers in everything.
Yeah, I mean, he would have probably seen the patent, right? Somebody who worked for him would very likely have seen the patent. But as far as I know, not the film. The film is there in the UK. The big moment was going to be the New York premiere. And remember, this is just like less than a year before that he has disappeared. So Edison has probably not seen the film or the movie camera. And so Lizzie can't like do much during this waiting period.
Tell you who can do something. Thomas Edison's invention factory never sleeps. They've already started to work on it, and they are going to be relentless.
Yes, yes. And so, as you'll remember, William Kennedy Laurie Dixon, our man, is on the job. And, you know, WKLD, he's keeping up with all this stuff that people are doing, with all the patents, and in fact tries to do like a movie projector-style movie at some point, but can't get that to work. The film just isn't, whatever, good enough or clear enough. And so he comes up with this other model instead, which is instead of projecting the movie onto a screen, onto the wall, they build a little box with a little hole in the top. And you look down into the box, like one person, and you see a little short movie of like, you know, a strong man lifting weights or whatever.
And actually, you know, this fits with Thomas Edison and his strength as a businessman, right? He wasn't looking at the movies as some sort of artistic form that was going to bring the world together, kumbaya. He was like, well, how do I put something in a box, get someone to put a nickel inside, we'll put my face on it, we'll put it in Coney Island, and eventually, like, I will have so many nickels, I can have a big room filled with them in West Orange.
You dive into them like a not very rich Scrooge McDuck.
So many nickels, right?
And Edison does, in fact, do this. He builds his little money machine, and people line up because it is this miraculous thing, moving pictures. And now he actually needs movies to show. It's like, oh, no, we got the box. People are lining up. We got to show them new movies so they'll give us more nickels. And, in fact, Dixon oversees construction of this movie studio, I think the world's first movie studio, although other people are working on things. And it's this weird building, and it's there in West Orange, right by the lab. And it's optimized to get sunlight, right? Because early cameras aren't very good. Early lighting is still not that good. They need a lot of light. So they do two things with this building that are just delightful. One, they have like a hinged roof so they can open it up and let the sun shine in. And two, it's on a big, like, turntable, so they can turn it so that the sunlight can come in.
It's like a retractable roof stadium.
Yeah, crossed with, like, one of those restaurants at the top of a tall building that spins around. Have you ever been to one of those? I've never been to one.
I have been to it. They move very slowly. They move very slowly. So. You know, I would pay a nickel just to, like, be in the studio and have it rotate with the sun.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Now you've invented the studio tour. Early films include blacksmith scene.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Washing the Baby.
Ooh, Oscar nominee.
And The Boxing Cats.
No way. One of the first movies ever is a cat video.
Yeah, and like, this has a very kind of, whatever, I don't know, Instagram, TikTok vibes,
sure,
right? Like,
yeah,
Washing
yeah.
the Baby is trad-wise.
Oh, yeah.
Blacksmith, I feel like there must be blacksmith influencers. So Edison's in the movie business, but he doesn't have it to himself for long, right? This is the simultaneous invention thing again, right? Over the next few years, more and more people are developing their own movie cameras, making their own movies. But of course, Edison is Edison, has, you know, as many lawyers as he wants at his disposal. And so he's does what is, I guess, the obvious thing, decides to basically sue everybody else out of existence.
Sure.
Clear the field. And so, you know, the first few companies, he goes and sues them like, oh, it's Edison. Okay, goodbye, whatever. We're done. But then he gets this one company that is doing pretty well. It's called the Mutoscope Company. And by this point, that company, which is Edison's main rival, is run by one William Kennedy Laurie Dixon.
WKLD, who left Edison, I assume.
Who left to go.
To go to a competitor.
Yeah.
Ah, and like this is classic. This is a classic moment in the age of innovation, right? It's not just ideas. It's this process knowledge of people who know how to do something and immediately are valuable and can go and start their own business or get hired by someone else. I mean, we saw this at the dawn of Silicon Valley, right?
Famously.
It's not, as you know, the guy who led the invention of the transistor, William Shockley. It's not even starting his big company, right? Shockley Semiconductor. It's his employees. The Traitorous Eight.
The Traitorous Eight. I love
Yeah, they leave, eight. They start their own company, and then they go start Intel. Like, this is how it works. This is simultaneous invention and taking those ideas and really seeding them to a bunch of different companies and competitors.
Yes. And in fact, the Mutoscope machines, the machines that Dixon's company is making, are quite like Edison's machines, right? They're not projecting on a screen. They're still, you look into a little box. And in the UK, the Mutoscope machines were known as the What the Butler Saw machines because their most famous movie was you look into this thing and you have the point of view like you're looking through an old school peephole, like a little key lock, you know?
Yeah.
And what you see is a woman taking off some of her clothes. And this was a smash hit. And so...
Yeah, of course it was. It was softcore porn.
Yes. Which, by the way, so now we're like, whatever, a few years into the history of movies, not a decade into the history of movies, and you have like cat videos and softcore porn. So you can basically shut it down now. No more innovation. That's it.
That's the thing that drives innovation, frankly, right?
Yeah, classic story of video, right? The porn industry and like video, the internet. Also, the Mutoscope, it turns out. So, okay. Edison sues Mutoscope. Mutoscope does not roll over. They hire their own lawyers. And their lawyer's legal strategy is to prove that Edison was not the first person to invent moving pictures.
Because they know who was. Louis LaPrince.
Yes.
Louis LaPrince did it.
His patent is right there, you know, for everybody to see. And so
he's not there, but his patent is.
His patent is. And the Mutoscope lawyers get in touch with Lizzie, you know, Louis's wife, and Adolph, his son. And, you know, like, this to them feels like their moment, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're just two people. There's no way they're going to be able to go up against Edison. But Mutoscope is a real company with revenues. And so Adolph gets ready to testify. He goes back to England. He gets the camera, the machine.
Yeah.
He takes the Roundhay Garden scene and, like, paste the images onto, like, you know, board for, so they can have it in court. He gets, like, sworn statements from people who were working with him.
And the family of Louis LaPrince can finally get this confrontation in a courtroom with, I assume, reporters there, the trial of the century.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's the Edison, right? You know, yeah, it's going to be in the papers because Edison, yeah, is involved, right? So the trial happens. Adolph, in fact, gets called to testify. And the Mutoscope lawyer asks him, do you have any films from this camera that your father invented? And Adolph, you know, shows the pictures of the Roundhay Garden scene, which you remember he was in it and his grandparents were in it. And then the lawyer says, when were these photographs taken? And Adolph says, October 1888, which again is, you know, well before Edison had his claim. And then the lawyer for Edison, like, I guess in cross-examination, says to Adolph, well, there's no way you can prove that October 1888 is when the movie was filmed. These are just pictures. And Adolph says, I can fix the date exactly by the fact that my grandmother, who, remember, was in the movie, by the fact that my grandmother died on the 24th of October, 1888.
The courtroom gasps.
And yet, it doesn't really work out for Adolph and Lizzie. This is the high point for them. But, you know, it becomes clear that, you know, the Mutoscope lawyers are not there to validate the claim of Louis LaPrince. In fact, at some level, they don't want, like, you know, LaPrince's heirs. They don't want Adolph and Lizzie to be able to, like, take away the movies from them. So they want to, like, do enough to undermine Edison.
Sure.
But yeah, not so much that they undermine themselves. Like, they don't even want to see the camera. And then there are these details where, like, Louis' U.S. patent was for the 16-lens camera and not the one-lens camera, and they don't want to know about that. And so ultimately, Adolph and Lizzie don't get the victory they want.
And afterwards, people aren't putting up statues to Louis LaPrince and putting him in the textbooks as, like, this huge inventor. I mean, he kind of gets lost to time.
He gets totally lost. And the court case, as intellectual property cases tend to do, goes on forever, right? It goes on for years and years, back and forth. The end of this Edison versus Mutoscope case is this very strange to me outcome. And that's this. The two companies get to keep their intellectual property and everybody else gets sort of wiped away. It's like, okay, you two, whatever. We're not going to sort it out between you two, but you two are good. You guys can keep making movies. And so what Edison and Mutoscope decide to do, once there's only two, what do you do if it's, whatever, 1900-ish? You form a trust. You're like, you know what? We could just compete each other down to bits, or we could just team up and not have to compete and share all those nickels.
Edison's got, like, a playbook. You either invent it first, or you patent it first, or you get the caveat, or you sue everybody. And, you know, if it looks like you're not going to win, you just say, let's get together. Like, let's dominate this industry. And in this particular case, they dominated the technology. They were making the movies. They had this, like, vertical corporation they were inventing.
Yes. And, you know, they really locked down not just the cameras and the projectors, but the whole industry. They actually bring in to their trust, it's called the Motion Picture Patents Company is the official name. They bring into their trust Kodak, because Kodak is making the film, right? And they already have their studio, so the actors are working for them. And this Edison Trust dominates the early movie business. And, delightful twist, this dominance helps to create Hollywood.
So Hollywood the place?
I mean, yes, but also, like, Hollywood the idea, the movie industry as we know it. Like,
okay.
So here's what happens. So the people who are buying from the Edison Trust are theater owners, right? They are not in the cartel. They are the ones paying the cartel.
Yes.
And they are not, like, big, highly capitalized ventures, right? These are, like, basically immigrant hustlers, guys who were like in the fur business a year ago.
Yeah, they're real estate guys, right? They own a
Maybe they have like a vaudeville theater, right? And they realize like, oh, instead of having to pay the actors, we could just put a movie up there and people will still pay, right? And so they really come to resent this Edison Trust.
Well, of course, because like buying from a cartel is terrible. You have no negotiation fee. They can lock you out of the business. They can put you out of business if you don't buy what they're asking for.
Yeah, it's great to be a cartel. It's terrible to be the customer of a cartel.
Exactly right.
And not only because they can jack up prices, right? But also because they can sell you a crap product. You know, like what you're not going to buy from anybody else. They don't have any incentive to make a better movie.
Yeah, and that's an unappreciated danger of a monopoly, right?
Yes,
is that we always talk about the money. Oh, I'm going to have to pay more for this monopoly. But it's really that there's no reason for the monopoly to innovate. Like, why would the movies have to be better or longer or nicely lit, you know, or something beyond what the butler saw? You don't have to innovate at all.
Yeah. And I mean, conversely, like the other side of the same coin is like competition is core to why a market economy is great.
Yes.
Right. Like you want many people, firms competing to make something better. You want 5 different companies, 20 different companies trying to make a better movie to sell it to the movie theaters. And when there's a cartel, you don't have that.
So how do they get to Hollywood?
Right. So
just distance from the New York cartel?
Well, so it's part of it, right? So here's what happens. The theater owners, who are the ones getting jammed by the cartel, they start making their own movies, but doing it on the sly. There are these stories where, like, they'll like have an Edison camera there, but then have secretly like one of the band cameras or a camera from Europe or something on the side. And, you know, part of trying to avoid the Edison Trust, which is headquartered in, you know, New Jersey, New York, is let's go far away. Like, how far away can you get? And the answer in the United States, just look at a map, continental United States, Southern California.
And plenty of that sun they need.
Yeah, so right. So it's not just Edison.
Yeah.
We should be clear. Like, there were a few other things. There was plenty of sun. Land was cheap, so you could, you know, buy your studio lot for cheap. There were lots of different landscapes, so you could film, like, your Western out in the desert. You could go to the mountains. You could go to the beach. And they weren't just hiding, right? Like, they were suing. There were antitrust laws. And, you know, we're into the kind of 1900s, 1910s at this point. And this is a moment when finally, the antitrust laws that have been on the books for decades are finally starting to be enforced in a meaningful way. And there are these Supreme Court decisions in 1917 and 1918 that say, oh, yeah, it's the Edison Trust is a trust. And we have these antitrust laws. You can't have a cartel.
It's right there in the name.
It's right there in the name. And they break up the trust.
Yeah.
And that's basically the end of Edison in the movie business and the beginning of Hollywood.
We still have one thread to pick up. What happened to Louis LePrince?
Yes, and we're going to tell the rest of the Edison story in just a minute. That's the end of the ads. Robert, give us an outline for the rest of the show.
Okay. 3 things we have left to do today. 1, figure out what to make of Louis LePrince and Edison in the movies. Like, what's our lesson here? 2, we're going to do the true crime thing. We're going to figure out who killed Louis LePrince. It's good, good. And 3, we're going to end our Edison series and talk about the end of Edison's life.
Okay. So first on that list is what to make of Edison and LePrince in the movies. Like, what is this story really about? And on this one, I want to go to Schumpeter. I thought it was Schumpeter, but I looked it up. It's Schumpeter.
Joseph Schumpeter. Wow, I've never said it like that.
Yeah.
Joseph Schumpeter, also known as Schumpeter in Silicon Valley, where they love this guy. Creative destruction. If you've heard that term, that's what he came up with and is still cited to this day. The idea that in order for progress to be made, big companies often fail and young, scrappy companies come up and take their place.
And so for Schumpeter, the sort of key hero was the entrepreneur. And there's this thing he wrote in 1911 that distinguished the inventor from the entrepreneur, talked about how they're different. And I think that distinction is the key for me in understanding this story, in understanding Louis LePrince, definitely the inventor, and Edison, who is clearly an inventor, but is also an entrepreneur. So read, Robert, if you would, this little thing that I pulled.
It's quoting time. As long as they are not carried into practice, inventions are economically irrelevant. And to carry an improvement into effect is a task entirely different from the inventing of it. And a task, moreover, requiring entirely different kinds of aptitudes. It is therefore not advisable, and it might be downright misleading, to stress the element of invention as much as many writers do. It's not about the invention.
And it's interesting, like, that last part, as much as many writers do, right? So he's sort of distinguishing here between what's happening with technology, with the economy, and how do we tell the story, right? And he's saying the story, the writing of it is like the invention.
Of course.
The person discovering the thing. But he's also saying, like, that's only one piece of it. And making the invention a thing in the world that people will pay for, is hugely important and super underrated. And, you know, if you map that idea to this story, you can say, well, so what that Louis Le Prince came up with the movie camera first, right? Everybody was working on it.
Someone was going to do it in the next year or two.
Yeah, somebody was going to do it. What's important is, in Schumpeter's words, carrying it into practice, making it a thing in the world, you know? Would Le Prince have done that if he had survived? Maybe, but maybe not, right? Like, that part is hard. He didn't have any money. We do know that Edison was really good at making things real.
The branding, the manufacturing, the money part, the lawyers, the patents, the building of the studio that could rotate feels like the kind of practical, like, we need to solve a problem and we need to film in New Jersey and this is what we've come up with.
Yeah, I mean, go back to that letter that you read that he wrote in October of 1888 when he just started working on this. You know, in the very first sentence, he says, yeah, we want to invent whatever, a camera. But then he says, in that first sentence, a camera in such a form as to be both cheap, practical, and convenient, right? Like, first sentence, he's not like, oh, movie's going to change the world. He's like, I want to make a thing that is cheap, practical, and convenient. That is the entrepreneur.
This actually reminds me of the discussion we're having today about China.
Huh.
Because, right, there's a whole thing about, well, China, like, do they really invent anything? We're the United States of America. We are the inventors. But what they have is process knowledge. They have what Schumpeter's talking about, focusing on cheap, practical, and convenient applications of technology. And through that constant iteration can often come out ahead without the aha lone inventor moment.
Yeah. Fast follower? Is that fast follower? Is that what they call that?
Yeah.
So think about Edison in this context, right? Like, he didn't just want to invent the light bulb. He wanted to deliver electric power to millions of people cheaply, you know, at scale. And he did. So he was definitely an entrepreneur. I mean, also, he was a flawed entrepreneur, right? Like, he invented the phonograph. Unlike with this, like, phonograph, he was way out in front and, like, was not the first one to bring it to market because he got distracted. He was the first one to build a big electric grid, but bet on the wrong kind of current, right, as we talked about. But fundamentally, he was an entrepreneur. And I would argue that that's why he is so famous as an inventor, right? Because we love stories of inventors, but we want stories of inventors whose things get out into the world. And so by being such a good entrepreneur, Edison became the most famous inventor in history.
This is where we will leave Edison for a moment, and let's move to number two, Louis Le Prince. Who killed him? It was probably not Thomas Alva Edison.
So for this one, I go back to Paul Fisher, the guy who wrote this relatively recent book about Louis Le Prince. And when I talked to Paul Fisher, we actually got into who killed Louis Le Prince in some detail. He has a pretty compelling theory. And it goes like this. The last thing we know Louis Le Prince did was he went to visit his brother.
In Dijon. Famous for their mustard.
Yes, I guess so. You know, there was this inheritance, right, that was something of an issue between them. The brother is the last one ever to see him alive. Hmm. And then, after he disappears, Lizzie's like, what should we do? Should we take out ads in the papers and, you know, see if anybody's seen him? And the brother says, no, I'm taking out ads in the papers. Don't worry. But when Paul Fisher, this author, went back to look in the papers, no ads. And so, like, that one seems pretty compelling to me.
It was the brother.
It was the brother, probably because of money. Like, boring, but boring is what you want, right? It's like the Occam's razor answer.
And I guess if Thomas Edison were listening to this show, he'd be like, yeah, of course. Like, I have lawyers. I don't need to kill people.
Right. That's right. That's why you get rich. That's why you become Thomas Edison, so you could take their ideas without killing them.
So that's the end of the movie story. And it seems like maybe this is the end of the series, right? So let's just do the rest of his life. Like, what is left for Thomas Edison to do at this point?
I mean, it's interesting, right? Because he's in his 40s when he gets into the movie business, like prime of his life. And he certainly doesn't feel like he's done. He's not done. He, for decades after this, keeps working. I mean, he's super famous. And he works on lots of different things. He works on a new kind of battery, still working on an electric car. He gets into the cement business, builds the Edison Cement Works or something, and actually pours these concrete houses in New Jersey, has this dream for the concrete house. I think you can still see some of these houses. He tries like 17,000 different plants looking for a domestic source of rubber.
Rubber, so you don't have to go to the Amazon.
Yeah, right. And this was like a national security concern at the time, like, I don't know, like rare earths today or something, but bigger. But none of these, I mean, like he makes some technical progress on them, but none of them are like big breakthroughs. He stays famous, right? Famous enough that, remember, like when he dies in 1931, the president of the United States declares this national moment of mourning. But if we take Edison by his own measure, you know, his own measure was not incremental progress, not the ideas for ideas themselves. It was things people will pay for. It was things that become a big thing in the world. In the second half of his life, he doesn't have any big hits.
But still, you really just have to step back and say, not only did he invent all these things, he created at least three industries, entire transformative industries, phonograph and the recording industry, the movie business, the electric business, which is in everything.
Yeah, like electricity was like the fundamental transformative technology of the 20th century. We can say Thomas Edison had a very good run. I mean, without Thomas Edison, you couldn't have like two guys talking into microphones and calling it a job.
Our producer is Gabriel Hunter Chang. Our engineer is Sarah Bruguer. And our showrunner is Ryan Dilley.
I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm Robert Smith. We'll be back next week with another episode of Business History.
A show about the history. Wait for it. Of business. Robert Smith, as you know, there is nowhere in Pushkin's office to make a video, to make a video podcast, which is unfortunate.
We tried, and it was described as two gray men in a gray box.
And reasonably so. Fortunately for us, in an amazing coincidence, literally down the hall from Pushkin's office, there is the showroom of a company called Buzzy Space. This is a company, it's where we're sitting right now. And what they do is they design furniture and acoustic solutions that make, I'm reading here, workplaces more comfortable, more creative, and more fun.
I would even say cozy. Their furniture is like sort of curved and interesting colors and I guess keeps things quiet.
Yes. Honestly, I wish our office was this showroom. You can find more at buzzy.space. That's buzzi.space.
All right. That was an episode of the new podcast Business History. Find more Business History on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.